This is the Education Gadfly Show.
It's that we have removed lead from gasoline and other things, and this is why graduation rate.
Oh, right. That's right. We should credit removing lead from lots of things.
It's the Kevin Drum hypothesis. Nice.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Michelle Obama of education policy, Kathleen Porter McGee.
I wish I were that stylish.
Well, it is about style. I'm not referring to her first lady role, though in some ways, you know, you being married to Mark Porter McGee, you know, you could argue you're like the first lady of education reform, except I think that you are more like co-president in this respect. Yes, more a Hillary to Bill sort of thing. Right. What was the line at the Golden Globes? Oh, look, it's Hillary Clinton's husband.
Right.
That's pretty cool. But the style.
I wish that I were that stylish, man. I know. Yeah. I love it.
It's exciting. I don't think we've had this since, Jackie O, right?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, the dress, I mean, I could tell the dress looked great. What with the bangs? People talking about bangs, too?
She has bangs, yes. Her hair is so now.
Yeah, and that's okay. Bangs are back in?
Apparently. I'm not that daring. I had a bang incident once. It was ugly.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of bangs, you know, both my boys were desperately in need of a haircut, and we got one this week. And you could tell, you know, have you ever been made to feel guilty by hair stylist people that you go to with your kids? I mean, they looked at us like we were bad parents. Like, these children cannot see the hair is over their eyes so much.
No, I actually get a hard time from my aunt, who thinks I cut my boy's hair way too frequently. She likes it a little bit longer and shaggier.
Everybody has opinions on these things,
and they
are happy to share them.
Yes.
All right, lots to cover in the world of education reform. Let's get started. Pamela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
In his second inaugural address, President Barack Obama mentioned two pieces of his K-12 agenda: to train more science and math teachers and to improve school safety. What significance might this hold?
Well, I mean, I think that obviously mentioning math and science teachers is something that he's talked about a lot and that a lot of people have talked about, really kind of elevating the STEM fields. I will say that until we more deliberately learn to link pedagogy and teaching people how to teach with content and really linking those two things in a much more meaningful way in terms of pre-service training and also actual quality professional development, I'm not sure that the massive amounts of money we're putting into it is going to make the difference we want it to.
You know, this was in a passage of the speech where he was basically calling for more collective action, that explaining that there are many things that we cannot do as individuals, we need government to do and to do together. And it was some line like, you know, no one person can train all the math and science teachers that we need, which was odd. But I also have to admit, I thought to myself, well, I don't know, Sal Khan thinks he might be able to do that if we just got, you know, why not have a flipped method? No, anyways, I do wonder. Somebody out there, go ahead, give it a try.
Yeah, right.
Let's train them all. Let's just find some master teachers and put some good stuff online, and maybe we can train all the math and science teachers with one person. I do wonder where this is coming from. I mean, there's energy for this, I guess, from certainly business leaders and from some parts of the reform community, this idea that the math and science, the STEM fields in particular, are going to be important. But I don't know, there's part of it that does rub me a little bit the wrong way, this putting STEM above the other subjects. I don't know. I'm just not convinced that they're necessarily
I mean, I understand, right, because hasn't historically there's been greater teacher shortages and teacher need, I guess, in STEM and then also in low-income classrooms. Although you could argue, to take the E.D. Hirsch view, that teaching content in fields like STEM is also teaching reading, so it would also kind of help in a variety of areas.
Yep. All right. Topic number two.
According to newly released federal data, the U.S. high school graduation rate reached a 35-year high in 2010, sitting pretty at 78.2%. Should we be skeptical or join the celebration?
We're always skeptical, right? I mean,
that is our job.
Yeah. I mean, I'd be skeptical, right?
Well, all right. The cause for skepticism is what?
Well, first of all, how are we calculating it? Are we giving diplomas to students based on evidence that they've mastered the content we want them to master before they graduate from high school? I mean, I think there's a whole host of reasons to be skeptical.
I mean, so two things, right? First of all, and I worry about this a lot, the credit recovery programs out there that allow kids to quickly catch up who are behind, and you say, okay, there seem to be no incentives in those systems to hold the line in terms of standards, like you said. You know, the second thing is, I haven't seen this reported, is, you know, in just the last couple of years now, as part of the No Child Left Behind, high schools are being held accountable for boosting their graduation rates. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, the graduation rates are going up. And again, this kind of squishy about what it takes for a kid to graduate, and you know, a teacher who might give an F but gives a D instead so the kid gets credit. I mean, it just seems like this could certainly be a matter of policy incentives driving the change, and a change that may not mean that we're actually getting more kids to where they need to be to reach standards.
Well, and especially if we're calculating graduation rates or saying we're going to judge school success in part on how many students graduate, but then completely divorce that, as you said, from mastery of important content. I mean, we want to increase graduation rates, but we also want to ensure that a high school diploma is a meaningful indicator.
You know, a lot of the smart people, including Jack Buckley over there at NCES, have been explaining it based on the economy, that you see this, that when unemployment goes up, so do high school graduation rates, because kids who would have otherwise dropped out see that they can't get jobs. Okay. Still, I think we're gaming it. Yep. So there's your skepticism. Oh, well, I should say, by the way, other people think it's lead. It's that we have removed lead from gasoline and other things, and this is why graduation rates.
Oh, right. That's right. We should credit removing lead from lots of things.
It's the Kevin Drum hypothesis.
Nice.
Yes. All right. Get the lead out. Okay, topic number 3.
Last week, Indiana heard arguments for and against sticking with the Common Core state standards. What would it mean if Indiana withdrew?
Well, obviously, it would give a really... It would really embolden Common Core foes, certainly across the country, and it would really give them a very clear victory to point to. I mean, I think it would be bad because it would kind of add momentum to the anti-Common Core rumblings.
Yeah, so I got to go to Indiana last week and testify on behalf of the Common Core in the Indiana State Senate, and I have to say it was a lot of fun. I mean, first of all, I don't get to do this sort of thing very often, and I was, from a sort of civic perspective, it was great. I mean, all the debates were out there. Mm-hmm. There were kind of 2 hours for the anti-Common Core arguments and more than 2 hours for the pro-Common Core arguments. Lots of perspectives, and the state senators, give them a lot of credit, were there and they were listening and they asked thoughtful questions. And you can tell that that people are really struggling with this. You know, there's certainly on the right, and particularly in the Tea Party right, a lot of concern about federal encroachment. So that's a big issue. But there were also important questions raised about the content, about, again, this question about fiction versus nonfiction. And then on the math side, and these points really seem to resonate, this worry that the Common Core in some way is pushing states and districts to move away from algebra at the eighth grade, to move away from acceleration, and is getting caught up in some of those larger debates as well. So, look, those of us that support Common Core, I think we still have some work to do to answer these questions and to make it clear to folks that these standards are going to actually make things better, not worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and then, that comes down to implementation and getting that right. And some of the things that I think people are debating in Indiana have more to do with effective implementation of the standards than they do with the content of the standards themselves.
Yeah. Now, all that said, Indiana is a special case for a couple of reasons. One is it did have excellent standards before the Common Core. That is unusual. You can only say that about a handful of other states. And the other thing is that, you know, their broad reform agenda that they've passed ends up getting caught up in the Common Core in an interesting way. So, for example, they have this new voucher program. It's very expansive, and it does require students who participate in the voucher program to take the state tests and for those results to be reported. Well, when those state tests become the Common Core tests, suddenly that means that to some degree you've got these private schools, including Christian and Catholic schools, accountable for the Common Core. And so that is also fueling a lot of concern that parents who have already opted out of the public school system, especially more conservative parents, sending their kids to Christian schools, and now their Christian schools in some ways are going to be judged by the Common Core. So that creates some more complicating factors, again, that you don't see in some other states.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right. I think that if they win this battle in Indiana, and they could, that will be a big scalp that they will take to other parts of the country.
Yep.
All right, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Pamela. Thank you, Kathleen. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
What do you think? Talking to Common Core here, your former teacher, as Fordham's research VP.
Yeah.
You feeling confident these days?
It makes me a little nervous, but we're all nervous, aren't we?
You know, all this blowback, it's, you know, to be expected. What is frustrating is how many of these other issues get conflated with the Common Core.
Yes.
Unfairly, in my view. So people say, oh, this is like outcomes-based education in the 90s, or this is a whole language, or this is, and people are latching onto that. You say, no, believe me, we at Fordham would not be in favor of these things if they were promoting all that silly progressive stuff. But, you know, some of these debates do get tough, especially as we've been chatting about, you know, algebra in the eighth grade and acceleration in math. And, it would, you know, we were pushing too many kids too fast who, you know, weren't succeeding because they weren't getting, you know, the depth that they needed. I mean, none of this stuff is easy to debate out in public.
Yeah. And the cost is another thing, right, which we did a report about. Yeah. It was, oh, you didn't include technology. I'm like, seriously, people, how can you really put a reliable estimate for technology for 40-some states that are all at different places? I mean, to come up with one number is just silly. And we've said before, you know, if you're in 2013 and you don't have a reliable computer infrastructure yet, hello, you should have had this before Common Core came to town. Yeah. So to act like, oh, you have to have it for Common Core, I mean, and Checker said this before, which makes perfect sense. It's the cost of doing business in 2013 is to be able to do online testing, you know.
Right. Now, I do wonder, and I wonder, like, are they going to be able to use tablets, for example, versus just PCs? I mean, the price of these things are dropping, but I don't know.
I think they're supposed to be device neutral, so you're supposed to be able to use them for a variety of different things.
Sweet.
So.
I think kids are going to be taking tests on their phones. Love it. All right, Amber.
Disable Google, sir, whatever.
Yeah, that's going to be tricky. All right, what you got for us this week?
New NBER study out by Carolyn Hoxby and colleagues called The Hidden Supply of High-Achieving Low-Income Students examines the college application behaviors and progress of these students compared to their high-achieving, high-income peers. Analysts pinpoint the vast majority of students who are high-achieving. They select students whose college aptitude scores place them in the top 10% of test takers. This is based on their 2008 performance on the SAT or ACT. Just an aside, about 40% of U.S. high school students take one of those tests, so we're talking about the top 4%. ACT and College Board also have the full list of schools that these students apply to, since they have to send along their scores. And they also, analysts also collect data about the students' neighborhoods based on the census. All right, top three findings. One, most high-achieving, low-income students do not apply to selective colleges or universities, even though these institutions would likely cost less, given their generous financial aid packages for these kids. Two, when these students do apply to selective institutions, they are admitted and graduate at rates similar to their high-income peers. Three, those low-income students who do behave like their wealthier peers in terms of their application behavior, because there are some kids that do that, they come disproportionately from large urban areas, about 15 large urban areas, Chicago, Philly, where they are likely to already attend selective magnet or other high schools with a critical mass of high achievers. These are the schools that Checker studied in his book. And the ones who don't apply to selective colleges tend to come from small or rural districts where there aren't a lot of high achievers, where they're unlikely to encounter teachers or peers who attended a selective college either. And then they end the study saying, you know, there's a couple pragmatic strategies that we might use to encourage some of these kids to apply to more selective colleges, one of which is using alumni who are already geographically dispersed to take a greater role in information dissemination and recruitment, and to customize college brochures to the student's situation, their interest, or financial situation. There you have it.
So, more exam schools is obviously one option too, right? I mean, there's a bunch of cities like LA that don't have any of these exam schools. And, you know, whereas places like New York have a bunch, it does seem like that is one way to both recruit those kids in one place and then have a culture, have the infrastructure, the college counselors, et cetera, that can push those kids to apply to these kinds of schools.
That's right. And, and Checker and Jessica Hockett got a big fat footnote in the study about their report. So that was good for them.
Nice. But it does remind me about that New York Times article over the holidays about the three young women in Texas, I think it was, who were growing up in poverty, and then what they did after high school. And, you know, all these pressures, sort of social, family, cultural, to not go so far away from home for college, you know, the boyfriends, the need, you know, all of that. That's hard to overcome, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you grow up in El Paso and you're going to, you know, go to Dartmouth. I mean, that's a tough one.
Yeah, right? It's a tough one.
Yeah, but particularly interesting to me that we used to think that we had a problem where we were overmatching these, that you had kids, either minority kids or low-income kids who were going to schools that were too difficult for them, mm-hmm. and they were not doing well because of affirmative action and things. But this newer research seems to indicate that they're actually going to schools that are not as challenging for them as they could handle.
That's right. We ran into this at the high school that I taught at, where the students we desperately wanted them to apply to more challenging students, particularly the top tier, but so many of them just had a geographic circle around the high school and they didn't want to go beyond that, and that limits the selective colleges pretty dramatically.
And why? Scared of leaving home?
There's a real strong pull to be closer to family, and it didn't have to do with a lot of other this is an N of, you know, I don't know what, a couple mm-hmm. hundred, so I'm not saying that these are, you know, that we can extrapolate a lot from these data, but it wasn't because of boyfriends or because it was really just a very strong desire to stay closer to the family. A lot of these kids were still giving back to their family, either by working and living at home and trying to reduce costs that way, or by providing childcare to younger mm-hmm. children. I mean, there were so many things mm-hmm. right. that played into the decisions, and so us trying to push them to apply more broadly, they just they weren't interested. So then what we tried to do was get them into honors programs in local public universities, so at least they were getting the best of the best.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one thing that the Hawksby was saying, that lots of times these selective institutions are, she called it, looking under their lamppost, find kids are already there, you know, as opposed to, you know, mm-hmm. doing a wider reach and getting beyond the geography. So
two questions. Do colleges get can they find out the names of kids who have scored well on the SAT? I mean, is there some kind of database, or is that protected by privacy?
Yeah,
can they target brochures to these kids?
I think they can get, I don't know what the private level, I mean, the student level data is always, you know, really tricky. Yeah. But I mean, if you know that the kids are supplying these data, right? The SAT and ACT know, you know, where the kids were applying to, because they have to send the scores.
Right.
I doubt that it's reciprocal, though. I doubt that, you know, the colleges could say,
I wonder if you know, can Dartmouth go out and say, hey, College Board, you know, give me the names of all the kids that scored at this level and who meet these demographics.
Yeah, knowing the College Board,
the second thing is, you know, do these institutions waive the application fees for poor kids?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a real issue, right?
I mean because these add up, right?
And you apply to them, so it's like,
right.
It costs
real money, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, so that's another thing to look at as well. All right. Very interesting stuff. It's great. You know, I don't think we've seen a ton of research from Carolyn Hawksby for a while. Mm. So it's, she's been busy doing other stuff. Mm-hmm. It's good to have her back in. She's brilliant. And she always asks interesting questions. Mm-hmm. All right. Great. Well, that is all of our time this week. Until next week.
I'm Kathleen Porter McGee.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.